I'd like to begin by asking you a question, and that is, how good are you at waiting? And what is it that you particularly find it hard to wait for? Because in our culture today, waiting is not usually a very popular thing to do, is it? For instance, we have our photos developed, don't we, at one-hour photo shops. We take our clothes to the same-day dry cleaners, and we buy our fast food at drive-through restaurants. Not only that, but we increasingly pay our bills over the phone and we do our banking on the internet, where there are no long queues of waiting people. And then when we're out and about and the lift perhaps takes a little while longer to arrive than we perhaps want, we often end up pushing the button several times in the hope that it will arrive that much more quicker. I do anyway. It seems today that we have become increasingly impatient. We just don't like to wait around, do we, with our instant coffee, our instant noodles, and even our instant text messaging services nowadays. The fact is that we just don't like to wait around. Well, tonight in our big picture series, in which we've been doing a little bit of a Bible overview, we've reached the subject of Jesus' return. And this whole subject of waiting appears front and centre. But before we go on to think about how we can wait well, I just want us to reflect for a moment on what Jesus tells us concerning his return. A moment ago, Reg read for us from Matthew chapter 24, and you might like to just turn back there so that you can follow along this evening. Matthew chapter 24 on page 994. And what we see in this section of Scripture is that, first of all, Jesus gives us a bit of a description of his return, which is verses 36 to 41 of chapter 24. And then he goes and follows it up with some short stories which describe how we should be living in the light of his return. So let's just take a look at the description to begin with. And as we do, we'll see three things. We'll see that Jesus' return will be unexpected, it will be sudden, and it will be divisive. So first of all, let's just take a look at the fact that it will be unexpected. Verse 36 tells us, "But about the day or the hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father." You know, there have been many over the years, haven't there, who have attempted to predict when Jesus will come back. I think that the Jehovah's Witnesses have tried to predict it about five times, which have all been incorrect. Then there have been various men like the American televangelist Jack Van Impe, who tried to predict the second coming on different occasions. The latest prediction he made was the year 2012, which of course has been and gone. After this, I think it was said that he gave up trying to predict the exact date, which was probably just as well. But even Sir Isaac Newton, a well-respected man like Sir Isaac Newton, said that he thought Christ's millennium would begin in the year 2000. But I suppose a lot of people did, didn't they? Perhaps you can even remember sitting there in your front room, nervously waiting for the clock to tick past 12 midnight at the beginning of that particular year, wondering what was going to happen. But you know, the fact is that they and we needn't have wasted our time, because Jesus clearly says that no one knows the day or the hour that it's going to happen. Not even the angels in heaven or Jesus himself, but only the Father. Therefore, Jesus says, we are to keep watch. There in verse 42 of chapter 24, he says, "Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know on what day your Lord will come." And he repeats it again in chapter 25, verse 13. "Therefore, keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour." Which makes it absolutely clear to us, doesn't it? That firstly, Jesus' return will be completely unexpected. Then next, we're told that it will be sudden. In verse 37, we read, "As it was in the days of Noah, so it will be in the coming of the Son of Man. For in the days before the flood, people were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage, up to the day that Noah entered the ark. And they knew nothing about what would happen until the flood came and took them all away. That is how it will be at the coming of the Son of Man. You know, we need to be aware that Jesus isn't waiting for some period of unprecedented evil in the world to take place before he returns. No, Jesus will come back at a time when everybody is going about their everyday business, just like in the times of Noah, the Bible says. What was Noah's day like? Well, it was all pretty normal, really, wasn't it? People were eating and drinking, nothing wrong with that. They were marrying and giving in marriage. Again, all pretty normal. They were buying and selling and continuing in all the everyday matters of life. Children went to school every day. Businessmen made deals. Teachers taught lessons. Doctors dispensed medicine. Farmers tended to their crops. Everyone was going about their business as they already always had done. And they certainly didn't pay any attention to crazy old Noah, who was building that big old boat in his back garden. And that's just how it will be, Jesus says, when he returns for a second time. People will be going about their everyday lives, involved in their regular activities. And of course, there's nothing wrong with any of those things we've just spoken about. These are things that the Bible would commend us to do. The problem here is doing these things without any reference to him. No reference to God or to the fact that Jesus will return. Not allowing that event to change how we live in the here and now. That's the real problem here. The fact is, we will know nothing about what's happening until it happens, Jesus says. Last summer I watched the film The Impossible. I don't know whether you've ever seen it. I think I've mentioned it in a sermon before. It was made a few years ago, and it's the retelling of real-life events of one particular family who experienced the 2004 Boxing Day tsunami in the Indian Ocean. Ewan McGregor plays the dad, and Naomi Watts plays the mum. And they go out for a few days before Christmas to Thailand. And it's wonderful. When they get there, they're upgraded, and they get this lovely chalet overlooking the beach. You see them there splashing and playing in the water and having fun, and they're eating and drinking. And then Christmas Day arrives, and they're there opening their presents together. And then that evening they go down onto the beach, and there's hundreds of people there, and they're all letting off these Chinese lanterns into the sky. And it's a really beautiful scene. It's idyllic. It's paradise, you might say. But you know, it's all a little bit awkward, because as the viewer, you know what is about to happen next. And so there they are on Boxing Day in the pool overlooking the ocean, and there's a rumble somewhere in the distance. And it gets louder and it gets louder until you see the absolute horror on their faces as they're greeted with this wall of water that's coming towards them. And then you see the utter devastation afterwards. And the rest of the film is them trying to find each other. It all looks so wonderful to begin with. And yet you know it's all just about to end. People will be eating and drinking, Jesus says. Carrying on as normal. And then the end will come and he will return. It will be unexpected. It will be sudden. And then thirdly, it will be divisive. From verse 40 we read, two men will be in a field. One will be taken and the other left. Two women will be grinding with a handmill. One will be taken and the other left. So who will be taken and who will be left here? Will it be those who love Jesus or those who don't? We know we don't know. This particular verse doesn't actually tell us that. It could be either. I mean, earlier in verse 31 of chapter 24, we're told that it's the Christians, the elect, who will be taken first. And there are other references to be able to support that idea in the New Testament. But then if you kind of follow the logic of those verses we've just read about Noah's flood, then it's the unsaved that are taken away, isn't it? And the saved remain. So So I don't think these verses can really be used to support any particular end time theory about whether as Christians we're going to be raptured off somewhere whilst Jesus judges the rest of the earth, or whether we'll remain here on earth when Jesus returns to establish his kingdom. We just aren't given that kind of detail here. And to be honest, I wouldn't get too het up about it. I think many well-meaning Christians have spent large parts of their lives debating and getting excited about this sort of thing, about exactly what's going to happen when Jesus returns. But I think the reality is that each of those main arguments, whether you count yourself as a premillennialist or a postmillennialist or an amillennialist or a pre-tribber or a post-tribber, I think they can all be successfully argued from the Bible, and they have been over the years. Why aren't we given the detail? Well, because the fact is, we don't need to know. We don't need to know exactly what's going to happen when Jesus returns. You see, it's not going to matter too much anyway, is it? We're going to find out when it happens. All we really need to believe is what the Apostles' Creed put so succinctly. We read there, Jesus was crucified, died, and was buried. On the third day he rose again. He ascended into heaven. He is seated at the right hand of the Father, and he will come again to judge the living and the dead. These are the minimal things when it comes to the end times that we need to agree on if we want to call ourselves a Christian. We need to agree that Jesus came, that he will come again, and that he will judge the living and the dead. However, the thing that we are told in these verses, verses 40 to 41, and it's the thing that we really need to take note of, is that there will be a division. Some will be taken to be with Christ forever in heaven, and others will face a Christless eternity in hell. Now, I don't think that division is ever popular, especially nowadays. If you've been to a funeral lately, or even if you've heard about someone dying, perhaps through the news, then you'll know that to be the case. Very often it's assumed, isn't it, by those who write the story, or the vicar, or whoever happens to be conducting the funeral, that the deceased has gone to heaven. I don't think I've ever been at a funeral where the guy at the front has said or assumed otherwise. Everyone goes to heaven, it seems, at that moment. And yet the reality is that people do have a dividing line that they draw in their minds, don't they? Most people believe that dependent on how good you've been in this life will depend on where you spend eternity in the next. But thankfully, Jesus draws the line differently, doesn't he? Thankfully, in God's book, our eternal state is not determined by how nice we've been in this life, which is a relief. It's not dependent on what we do, whether we do good or whether we do bad. It's dependent on whether or not we've trusted in Jesus Christ and his finished work at the cross. In fact, when you think about it, Jesus' line is a lot more inclusive and generous than ours is. If you work on that nice versus nasty principle, for instance, that nice people get to go to heaven and that nasty people don't, then it kind of begs the question, well, where do you draw the line? How nice do you have to be? Do you get in? Do I get in? I know that I get angry at times. I know that I'm selfish on other occasions. I know I don't always meet my own moral standards. So does that mean I'm out? Or what about if you've been a bad person for the first 60 years of your life, but then in the last 5 years you've turned your life around and you've become this model citizen? Does that get you in? Well, surely not if you do the math, 60 versus 5. But Jesus says you can believe in him at any stage of your life. It doesn't matter if you believe in him on your deathbed. Although I really wouldn't risk leaving it that long, given what we've been talking about this evening already. But all the same, Jesus' deal is pretty inclusive, isn't it? I would suggest. And yet the sad fact remains that there will be ultimately a division between those who choose to believe in Jesus and those who don't. And we need to make a decision about which side of that line we're on. So to sum all this up, when Jesus returns, it will be unexpected, it will be sudden, and it will be divisive. So knowing all of this, having trusted in Christ alone for your salvation, how do you wait well for his return? What are we to do in the meantime as Christians? Well, Jesus goes on to tell us how to live using several short stories, three of which we're going to briefly look at now. And the first one is be ready. There's a burglar coming. Verse 42 says, therefore keep watch, because you do not know on which day your Lord will come. But understand this, if the owner of the house had known at what time of the night the thief was coming, he would have kept watch and would not have let his house be broken into. So you also must be ready, because the Son of Man will come at an hour when you do not expect him. Now, I don't know how many of us have had our houses burgled before, but if you have, you'll know that it's not a nice thing to happen to you. I've been involved with a house that's been broken into before. It wasn't actually my house, which already sounds a little bit dodgy, doesn't it? So I'm just going to explain that. The thing is, we happened to be renovating a big house on the North Norfolk coast. It was a second home for some folk that lived in London at the time, and no one was living there at that moment. And then one particular morning, we turned up for work and found that the side window had been smashed and the place had been turned absolutely upside down. The owner's belongings were strewn everywhere. But the only thing that was missing, as it turns out, was my power drill, complete with case. Well, fortunately, they eventually caught the guy after a series of similar burglaries in the town. It turns out that he wasn't the smartest tool in the box, but sadly he had long since sold off my drill. Now, as Jesus' story goes, if I had known in advance that this guy was going to burgle that house on this particular night, then I would have been ready. For one thing, I would have taken my drill home with me on that particular evening. I wouldn't have left it there to get stolen. What other precautions could we have taken? Well, I suppose we could have got a couple of hefty bricklayers to lay in wait for this guy. Or we could have bought a big dog to guard the place. Or we could have done the sensible thing and just informed the police beforehand. But the point is, we would have done something. We wouldn't have just carried on and done nothing with that sort of advanced knowledge. Well, getting back to Jesus' point here, what if you knew that in a few months, say, what if, and I'm not making a prediction here, but what if Jesus was going to return for sure on the 1st of August 2018? I wonder what difference would knowing that make to each of our lives right now? You know, I'm sure that there are things that we're stressing about at the moment that in light of Christ's sudden return in a few months' time, we wouldn't be so bothered about anymore, would we? On the other hand, I'm sure that there'll be things that perhaps we haven't paid as much attention to, that we'll be thinking to ourselves, hang on a minute, I've only got 3 months left. I really do need to get that sorted. I need to speak to that person. I need to have that conversation. We need to work this thing out together before it's too late. I wonder, thinking about that, are there any chats that you or I need to have? Or things that we perhaps need to resolve with other people that we know? I'm sure that if we had that date in our diaries, then it would really start to bring things home to us. It would cause us to change the way we live right now. Our habits, our conversations, and what we spend our time doing. It really would begin to make a real difference to our lives, wouldn't it? Well, you know, Jesus says you don't know the time or the date. In fact, no one does apart from God the Father. So you can laugh at those who tell you that they do. But the fact that I'm coming back, well, that's not in doubt. I will be coming back, Jesus says. But at an hour when you least expect it. So be ready. Be ready. Surely that makes it even more essential to sort out those things whilst we still can. Next, Jesus says that if we're going to wait well, we need to be faithful. The point being that waiting for Christ's return is not a passive activity, it's an active one. Verse 45 says, "Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant whose master finds him doing so when he returns. But suppose that servant is wicked." Now, there are two characters in this story. There's the master and the servant. Note, there aren't two servants here. There's just the one. And initially, as we see, he does the right thing. But then that same servant chooses to do the wrong thing, as the story then goes on to tell us. But suppose that servant, we read in verse 48. So it's clearly the same servant here, but with two very different outcomes. And the point that Jesus is trying to make to us here is it's no good starting well only to kind of conk out in the end. That's the warning here. As we see at first, this servant is pictured as the height of reliability, of taking his responsibilities seriously, of using his God-given gifts in order to serve others. In this particular case, the servant's job is to feed his fellow servants. That's what he's been given to do. And his master says that if he were to come home and find his servant faithfully doing this, faithfully fulfilling his duty, then the servant would be given further responsibility. Now, of course, being a parable, Jesus is speaking of himself as the master here, and the Christian believer is pictured as that servant. The point being that if Jesus returns to find us going about his business and doing what he's gifted us to do and serving him, then he will be pleased and we will be rewarded and we will be put in charge of many things, as Jesus says here. What does that mean? Well, again, we're not exactly told. But I'll tell you what, it's surely something far better than what we're doing now. In fact, this whole idea of being rewarded when Christ returns for being faithful in our lives now is something that we find repeated throughout Matthew's gospel. So it really is going to happen. We will be rewarded, even if we don't quite know what that reward's going to be. It's sure to be something amazing if Jesus has got anything to do with it. But what if the servant isn't faithful? What then? Well, that's the second half of this parable, isn't it? Verse 48 says, "But suppose that servant is wicked and says to himself, 'My master is staying away a long time.' And he then begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with drunkards." This servant doesn't deny that the master will return one day. But he clearly doesn't believe that it will be any time soon. And so the reality of Christ's return no longer has any bearing on how he goes about living his life right now. Of course he knows that Jesus will return one day, but not for a while yet, and certainly not in his lifetime, he presumes. Don't be like that servant, Jesus says. This distant hope, as someone has put it, leads to delinquent faith. Whereas having a near hope, an ongoing consciousness that Jesus will return one day, and that day might even be today, will begin to affect our relationships right now with God and those around us. And it will cause us to be faithful in them. Verse 50, the master will come on a day when he does not expect. And then verse 51, what do we make of this verse? He will cut him to pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Well, I think at the very least, this this verse causes us to kind of sit up and think, doesn't it? You know, Jesus doesn't say these things to be unkind. He warns us about these things because he loves us and he doesn't want us to end up in a place like this. I think as Christians, we can sometimes get so blasé about our faith, perhaps, and our relationship with God, that knowing him sometimes doesn't really seem to have an everyday effect on our lives. Well, if that's the case for us, then Jesus says, be warned, because it needs to. Knowing Jesus needs to have a real impact on our lives. It needs to make a real and noticeable difference in our relationships, in the things we say and do. So be faithful, Jesus says, and keep serving. And then finally, and more briefly, Jesus shares another story about how we can practically wait well. There in chapter 25 and verses 1 to 13, with this parable of the 10 virgins, or the bridesmaids as they were. And here we learn that we are to be patient. I'm sure you're all fairly familiar with this parable. Reg read it earlier as well, didn't he? So I'm not going to go into lots of detail here, but just to fill you in with a bit of the background. It was common in those days, as you might know, on the wedding day itself, for the bridegroom to go to the bride's house for the ceremony and get the legal bit done there. And then for the bride and groom, along with a great procession, to return back to the groom's house, where the feast then took place, which would have often lasted up to a week. And so here are these 10 bridesmaids, and they're waiting to join this procession, to escort this married couple to the wedding feast. But the trouble is that the groom's late. He's got way late. I don't know, maybe he was caught behind, maybe doing his hair or polishing his shoes or something like that. But whatever the reason, we're told that he's been delayed. And in the meantime, the bridesmaids have all fallen asleep. And then the announcement's made that the groom has finally arrived. And what happens? Well, we find that 5 bridesmaids are ready and 5 aren't. 5 have oil in their lamps and 5 don't. If you ever heard this parable spoken on before, you'll know that all sorts of things have been said about it, and reasons given as to what the oil represents here and things like that. But you know, all we're really told here is that the bridesmaids, they weren't prepared for a delay. They weren't prepared for a delay. I think one of the most immediate, or the immediate comfort that we perhaps can draw from this parable is the fact that it does tell us that there will be a delay. And after 2,000 years since Jesus' death and his resurrection, I think it's mighty comforting, isn't it, to know that. Expect a delay, Jesus says. But how do we wait with that in mind? Well, as I said, we must wait patiently. Yes, there are some moments in our Christian lives that are great. We have, don't we, some mountaintop experiences in our Christian lives. The day we were saved, for instance, or that particular conference we went to, or that weekend away that we enjoyed. But you know, most of the time, our Christian lives just aren't like that, are they? Most of the time, our day-to-day Christian lives are all about patiently serving Jesus as we wait for him to return. And you know, that might seem dull to us at times. We might be tempted even to fall asleep like those bridesmaids did. But Jesus says we need to keep going. As someone's put it, it's no good being a zealous Christian in your 20s, getting slightly tepid in your 30s, and going off the boil in your 40s. We need to keep going. We need to keep serving all the way through. We need to keep that oil topped up in our lives at all times. So in conclusion this evening, Jesus says, I'm coming back. It will be unexpected, it will be sudden, it will be divisive. So keep watch. How do we do that? Be ready. Make sure those issues are constantly resolved in our lives. Never let the sun go down on them. Be faithful. Use the gifts that God has given us for his glory and be patient. Don't give up. Even though there's a delay and perhaps it's tempting to sit back and fall asleep, we need to be spiritually prepared at all times.